I take the invitation to come to Perth more often. I'd very much like to do that. As many of you would know, of course, we do have a representative office here, very ably headed by Virginia Christie, who many of you will have encountered in her efforts to do the very important liaison work that we rely on. So there's quite a presence here, and it's a very active one, but I'm certainly happy to come to your beautiful state more often. In the process of deciding the title of today's address, which is still interesting times, where that comes from is that I can recall 3 years ago in late 2008 I was giving talks which were in essence saying the times were quite interesting, maybe a little bit too interesting, and it would be good if they were more boring. Unfortunately, internationally at least, they continue to be just a little too interesting. As you know, the Reserve Bank Board met here in Perth yesterday, and we reviewed the information to hand and decided once again to leave the policy rate unchanged. The reasons for the decision were given in the statement released after the meeting, as usual. More information on the nature of the discussion and the things that the board took into account are, of course, going to be contained in the minutes of the meeting, which are published in a couple of weeks' time. I know that you're undoubtedly looking forward with eager anticipation to reading those minutes, so I won't foreshadow them. What I will do is talk at a sort of a higher level, more generally, about the sequence of decisions the board's taken in recent months. To give some context to that, I think it is worth setting out again, and this is all a matter of public record, but it's worth going through briefly again what the framework for monetary policy is. So I'll say something about that and then talk about how we have viewed recent events within that framework. So the framework for policy is a medium-term flexible inflation target. It seeks to keep the rate of CPI inflation between 2 and 3% on average over the medium term. That arrangement actually has quite a bit of history now. The Reserve Bank began to articulate it in the early 1990s, and it's been enshrined in formal agreements between successive treasurers and governors from 1996, starting with Ian Macfarlane and Peter Costello, and we're up to, I think, the fifth incarnation now of that agreement between myself and Wayne Swan. So it's 2 to 3% on average. The on average part of that recognises that we can't fine-tune inflation over short periods, so we can't actually be between 2 and 3 all the time. And indeed, we're not between 2 and 3 right now. So it takes account of our inability to fine-tune and also the obligation we have to take account of the real economy. That's the full employment part of the charter that James spoke about. Having a numerical goal, the 2 to 3 part, that what that does is it recognises the importance of anchoring expectations of inflation, which is critical for any monetary policy arrangement, and it provides a focal point, or if you like, a measuring stick against which to judge policy decisions over time. So it has, I would say, the right elements of an anchor, a constraint, but a certain degree of short-term flexibility appropriate to our task. We got to that framework after a very long search. If you go back and read Ian Macfarlane's Boyer lectures in 2006, which are entitled The Search for Stability, it recounts the long process post-World War II through the 60s, 70s, 80s, and into the early 90s of the various other monetary policy systems that we tried and which were found wanting in one way or another. This framework isn't necessarily the end of history. It's not that It's impossible for there to ever be something better, but it's worked well for nearly 20 years now, and there's no obviously superior framework that's on offer. Sometimes people ask us whether it wouldn't be a good idea to have a higher target for inflation than 2-3%. That question tends to get asked when inflation looks like it might be going up and when the Reserve Bank's setting in place a policy designed to resist that. Well, actually, the 2-3 for developed countries is probably already a touch higher than many countries would choose, only a little bit. But more importantly, the answer to whether higher inflation would be good really hinges on how prepared we are to accept all the other things that go with that. And one of the very first things that would go with higher average inflation would be higher interest rates. There's no reason that savers, any more than wage earners, would accept erosion of their position from inflation. They would demand compensation for that in the form of higher nominal interest rates, and that's why high inflation countries have high nominal interest rates, and it's the low inflation countries that have low ones. Moreover, whatever structural challenges the economy faces, and we do have some, we would still face those if inflation were higher. Higher inflation wouldn't make that go away, and indeed we know that from our own history. We've faced other periods of structural change when inflation was higher than it is now, and it wasn't any easier than it will be this time. So I think that the current target, which we've had, as I say, for nearly two decades now, remains a sensible one for us to pursue. In supporting the decision process that we go through each month, the staff does a huge amount of statistical work. The RBA staff track several thousand individual data time series. They conduct extensive liaison around about 100 organisations a month, are spoken with in detail. We publish voluminous analysis of all that. There's a huge amount out there. And the object of all that, really, in the end, is fairly simple. What we're trying to do is to form an assessment of the strength of demand growth in the economy and how that's travelling relative to the economy's estimated potential to supply that demand. That assessment, in turn, informs a judgment as to whether inflation is likely to go up or go down or not change much. And from there, we get to a decision about whether monetary policy needs to restrain demand, to boost it, or to do neither, to be neutral. Now, there are many complexities in there, and there are many other things that in the short term also affect inflation. The exchange rate, which is affected by monetary policy, but also by many other things, the international price of energy and so on, all these things have to be taken into account. Notice also that I talk about the economy's supply potential, quote unquote. There isn't any ABS statistic you can look up labelled potential supply. We have to make an estimate of what that is, making assumptions about the availability of labour and capital, and, very importantly, about the productivity with which those factors are used. And this is why, actually, the productivity debate, which is increasing at present, is so important. It's about long-run supply potential, which ultimately drives our living standards. Incidentally, the call for higher productivity is not a call for people to work harder or longer hours. That's not actually the point at all. Australians actually already work quite long hours by international standards. The point, you don't actually add to productivity per hour by working more hours. You add to productivity per hour, which is what counts, by making the hours which are already being contributed more effective. That's actually the point of the productivity discussion. Well, the board's decision, our reasoning behind it, are communicated publicly each month. If you looked in the papers today, you'll see detailed analysis of every phrase in that statement. These are probably, perhaps with the exception of court judgments, the most closely scrutinised documents in the country. I'm often amazed, actually, at the layers of hidden meaning that people are able to detect in them that I didn't realise were there. But the main purpose of those statements isn't really to just provide raw material for the media, but is to try to communicate as simply as we can what our assessment is of the outlook, because we assume that that assessment and the policy implications of it are important information for people like you who have to make long-run decisions that are important for the well-being of the economy. Now, of course, we can form our judgments, but events come along, new information comes along, and the outlook changes. At times it changes quite a bit, as we've seen recently. So let me then go on to talk about how we've been thinking about events over the past year within the framework that I've set out. Well, over that time, the forecasts that our staff have been presenting to the board have suggested that underlying inflation, which had been falling since the middle of 2008, would probably stop falling and in due course start to go up again. This isn't about banana prices, by the way. We keep reading that policy may or may not respond to things like that. We don't respond to those sorts of things. We ignore them. It's the longer run trend in inflation that we're interested in. And the backdrop to this view that underlying inflation would stop falling and start to go up was that the rise in the terms of trade, which is very large, as I don't need to tell you here in Perth, that's expansionary for incomes and investment, and that would probably see overall demand growth remain pretty strong, even as the fiscal stimulus payments of a couple of years back were going to unwind. The exchange rate was working to offset some of this expansionary impacts. It restrains those parts of the economy which are exposed to international trade but not exposed to mining. Nonetheless, given the size of the terms of trade rise, which is very large, given that we started from a position of reasonably low unemployment, so not some spare capacity but not all that much, we thought it was more likely that inflation would start to go up than that it would keep falling. And on the evidence we have so far, roughly speaking, that's what's turned out to occur to date. Core inflation has stopped falling and gone up a bit. Well, faced with that outlook, the board felt that it was appropriate for monetary policy to exert a certain degree of restraint. At the end of last year, we felt we had reached that position, and we thought, therefore, that we were able to then anticipate a period of sitting still for a while to see how things went. And the post-board statements that I issued each month, starting in December last year and then through to quite recently, said that the board viewed the stance of policy then in place as, quote, appropriate for the outlook, unquote. Of course, there are always uncertainties surrounding our forecasts. Our forecasts are, I think, as good as most people's, which is to say they're not all that good. Economic forecasting is a very uncertain and imprecise art. So there are always uncertainties, and one of the things we have to do is to think about not just the central outlook that we have, but how things might be different to that. And we actually put a lot of time into thinking about various other things that could occur that are not in the central forecast. And we often articulate these in our published documents. One of the things that we've talked about from time to time is the possibility that sovereign debt concerns internationally could lead to turbulence and problems in financial markets, and indeed that is what we're seeing now. Many of the risks or uncertainties that we contemplate don't come to pass, and even when they do, they don't always unfold in the way we thought that they might. Nonetheless, we do spend quite a bit of time thinking about the ways in which things might turn out differently to our central expectation. By the time of our May meeting, just a few months back, there was evidence that the pace of underlying inflation had started to rise. I personally felt at that time the board was still well placed to sit still because we'd already put in place some degree of restraint in policy in anticipation of that development. Nonetheless, when we updated our forecasts going out into the future, those forecasts did carry a message, which was that if things turned out the way the forecast had them, policy would need, most likely, to be tightened further, quote, at some point, unquote. We didn't say when that point was, and we didn't actually have a strong presumption about it, but that is what we said, and indeed we could say nothing else that would be credible faced with the forecast that we had. Of course, in the ensuing months, a few things have happened. The outlook for the resources sector doesn't look any weaker. More large projects have been approved, and the pipeline of future investment still looks very large. On all the information we have, resource sector investment for the country will probably rise by another 2% of annual GDP, which is a lot, over the next couple of years. Prices for important commodities remain quite high, and in fact Australia's terms of trade, the ratio of export prices to import prices, which is a measure of national income, are at an all-time high right now in the September quarter. At the same time though, it's become clearer, I think, that precautionary behaviour by households and some firms is exerting restraint on the pace of growth in demand in other sectors. And it's also clear, I think, that the exchange rate is diverting some Australian demand to be filled from offshore. Moreover, the sense that the high exchange rate might not just be temporary, but might be more persistent, is, I think, probably leading to a pickup in the pace of structural change in the economy. So in net terms, the outlook for the non-resource part of the economy in the near term is weaker than it looked a few months ago. And we can add to that the recovery in flooded coal mines in Queensland is taking longer than was assumed when the floods occurred. And that's all been reflected in downward revisions to our forecasts. At the same time, when we look at the pace of growth of credit to asset prices, the exchange rate, these things say that monetary policy is exerting restraint. There are other things that affect those variables, but together they suggest that monetary policy is exerting restraint. And these things were incorporated in our most recently published outlook, which was at the beginning of August. Meanwhile, of course, unease in Europe about how they are going to deal with their problems has increased over recent months. It continues to increase. We've also had the anxiety over the US debt ceiling issue, which was quite acute around about the time we were making our August interest rate decision. Measures of confidence both in the US and Europe have declined quite noticeably in the last month or two. Equity markets have come down as investors shifted to the relative safety of bonds, including bonds issued by the US, which had just been downgraded by S&P. So there you go. It's too soon really to see any evidence either way of the effect that this will all have on the global economy more broadly. So any assessment we make right now is very preliminary, and we have no way of knowing what things will transpire in international financial markets or the major economies over the next several months. Indeed, there are any number of hurdles in Europe and in the US that may well provide a catalyst for anxiety over the period ahead, and I think that state of affairs is likely to persist actually for quite a while. Having given those caveats though, let me offer a few preliminary observations about this particular episode in comparison to what we saw 3 years ago in 2008. Firstly, the focus this time is more on sovereign creditworthiness rather than bank balance sheet creditworthiness per se, though of course in Europe these two things are quite closely linked. But the focus on sovereign credit is important, and in approximate sense that is the direct result of the crisis itself, in that the deep recessions that major countries had have seriously impaired their revenues and exposed weaknesses in their budget positions. In fact, taking a longer-term perspective, a number of countries, especially in Europe, have had fiscal positions which have been very vulnerable to a shock to confidence for quite some years, actually. Very high debt levels have been in place for some time in a number of countries. And high debt is, in a way, it's sustainable while everybody thinks it is. While the markets think it's sustainable and they will lend at low interest rates, then it is sustainable. But if one day people wake up and feel that for some reason suddenly it isn't sustainable and want to charge you a high interest rate, then that makes the position itself much less sustainable than it was. So in a sense, in a very real sense, this is a matter of confidence. That is, confidence that there is a sustainable long-run fiscal path for these major countries, confidence that the policymakers know how to get onto that path, and confidence that they have the will to do that. And this is really the issue which is at the heart of what we're seeing in Europe at the moment, and also less acutely maybe, but I think in a very real sense also in the United States. So this focus on sovereign risk is something that wasn't there to the same extent 3 years ago. A second observation is there have been some pressures in funding markets for European banks recently, and that is similar to 2008, is not as acute now as what we saw then, at least not so far. That said, bank capital levels are better, their leverage is lower than 3 years ago, and we haven't seen, as far as we can tell, significant funding problems for UK or US banks in this episode to date. Their problems in those countries at the moment for banks seem to be more related to the potential legal costs that might arise from poor pre-crisis lending standards. So overall, at this point, we haven't seen the almost complete reluctance to or withdrawal from dealing with counterparties in the financial world that we saw 3 years ago. And that's good. Third observation I'd have is that a feature of this episode, which is a little bit new, is that confidence in the euro is a more prominent feature here. The countries that are in the so-called periphery of the euro, Greece, Ireland, Portugal, they are paying quite a high price to play their part in keeping the euro together. But the ultimate conclusion really is going to, or the ultimate outcome is going to hinge on the willingness of the core countries, by which we really mean France but mainly Germany, to accept some socialisation across the euro area as a whole of some of the losses which are associated with the countries in trouble. And really that's the core issue that is in question and being debated in Europe at present. Another observation that I'd offer is that were there to be a major international economic downturn, an important question would be the way that policymakers in various countries might respond to that if it occurred. We don't know if that's occurring at the moment. It's a bit early to tell. I don't think we should assume it is. But if it did, how would people respond? Well, here is where it gets interesting. The scope for fiscal stimulus in major countries is hotly debated. Some commentators are calling for further stimulus right now, and they cite struggling recoveries as a reason to do that. Other people say that the long-term debt dynamics of Europe or the US are sufficiently troubling that what we really need is fiscal consolidation, not fiscal expansion. Well, both these arguments have a point, really. And the question really is whether in some of these major countries it would be possible to craft an expansionary measure in the near term coupled with a credible path back to sustainability over the medium term. Could that be done or not? I don't know. It certainly doesn't look like an easy task, but that may be what some of these countries may be faced with. As for monetary policy, well, in many of the major countries, of course, interest rates are already at zero, and further responses would take them further into what we might call quantitative methods, that is, buying securities and expanding the central bank balance sheet. They're already doing that in the US, in the UK, and to a certain extent also in Europe. So any monetary response would be largely in those terms, and it's actually hard to gauge what the effects of that are. But in Asia and in other parts of the emerging world, ample policy ammunition remains of the conventional kind, both fiscal and monetary, should the authorities there feel that they need to use it. So they could cut rates and they could do budget expansions if that were appropriate. Whether that would be done or could be done credibly would presumably depend on whether the higher inflation that they've been seeing in recent times was in the process of turning down. Now, if we did have a significant weakening of global growth, that would presumably lower commodity prices to some extent and take some of the pressure off inflation, and that might make it easier for those countries to act in an expansionary way. So far, the decline in most commodity prices we've seen is not like the collapse we saw 3 years ago. They've come down somewhat, and that's enough to help CPI inflation peak and start to moderate a bit, but we haven't seen a major decline, at least not so far. So in summary, that's a long-winded way of saying that internationally the current environment presents a number of quite considerable challenges, though we should not, I don't think at least at this point, assume that this is just 2008 all over again. It is reasonable to conclude, I think, that the outlook for global growth is weaker than it looked some months back, and most forecasters are tending to revise down their global growth estimates at the moment for 2012 and for 2011, mainly as a result of weaker outcomes expected in the major countries. Well, that's the global picture. Turning back to the implications for Australia, when we have these periods of sudden increases in anxiety in global markets, it's good, if it's possible, it's a good thing to be in a position to maintain steady policy settings in Australia. And in the recent few meetings, the board has judged that it was prudent to sit still, even though we have been faced with data on inflation which were on their face, at least, concerning. To be in the position to be able to do that, of course, requires that you've taken timely action in earlier periods when things were calmer to address those likely trends in inflation. And I think we did do that, so we were in a position recently to sit still. As we look ahead, the task for the board is to try to assess what bearing the recent information we have and the recent developments we've seen will have on the medium-term outlook for demand and for inflation in Australia. These events probably won't make much difference, I don't think, to the outlook for the resource sector. I think all those large-scale plans that are currently rolling through, that will all continue. But households and firms in the rest of the country watching what's been going on locally and internationally may well continue this pattern of precautionary behaviour for longer than they otherwise might have. That would presumably dampen demand to some extent compared with the outlook that we published a month ago, and it might also in time condition wage and price setting behaviour. And if that happened, then that might act to some extent to curtail the upward trend in inflation that has seems to be in prospect up to now. So that's the question, the extent to which that will occur. At the same time, of course, we still have significant rises in a number of administered prices and utilities mainly to come. We have observed that because of the relatively slow performance of productivity, that means that unit costs in business have been rising on average actually pretty quickly over recent years. Well, that is inflation, and that is something that we have to keep an eye on. And in fact, as my deputy governor recently said in a very good analysis of recent events, when we look back to what we expected a year ago and compare the outcomes we've seen to that expectation, growth is lower, but inflation actually is a little bit higher than what we had expected. Now, that might be just the vagaries of statistics, leads and lags, and so on, or it might be telling us that the combination of growth and inflation that can be achieved in the economy is a less attractive one than it had seemed to be in earlier years. If that was the case, then that fact would again put the spotlight back onto all the supply side issues, productivity and so on. Well, it's probably time that I wrapped up and let you get on with your day, so let me conclude. More than at most times in my professional life, the Australian economy faces a set of very unusual and rather powerful group of complex forces. Major countries in the world are still coming to terms with the excesses of earlier years, and they're learning what many have already learned in the past, which is that after a period of financial distress, such as they've seen, it's usually a long and difficult process of recovery. In those countries, economic growth has been uneven and patchy, and financial concerns keep recurring, as we're currently seeing. Waves of positive and negative sentiment sweep across global markets, and Australians feel those waves of sentiment. Meanwhile, the emerging world is continuing to expand, and that isn't actually all just due to exports to the rich world. We could do with some more rebalancing of global growth, but it is occurring, and the emerging world is starting to generate more of its own growth dynamic. Indeed, there's an epochal change occurring here with the way the emerging world expanding its share of global growth, and Australians are feeling the effects of that as well. That effect actually in aggregate is overwhelmingly positive for us, even if our tendency, not so much in the West, but maybe in other parts of the country, to dwell on the downside is on display, and that is on display at the moment. But these epochal changes in the global economy are, without doubt, fundamentally positive for Australia. So the future's uncertain, but that's always true. It's perhaps a bit more uncertain now than usual, but it is always uncertain. What we know, though, as we move into that future, whatever it will bring, is that we do so with our terms of trade at a record high. We do so with more jobs in our economy than ever before, with 95 out of every 100 people available for work are in a job, or in WA that's actually 96 out of 100. We do so with our banks sound, our financial system stable, and our sovereign credits highly respected around the world. And we do it with a capacity for macroeconomic policy here to respond to events in a sensible way, guided by well-established frameworks that have worked well for quite some years. We have our problems, without doubt, but I think with some good sense and careful judgment, we ought to be able to navigate whatever lies ahead. So thank you very much for your attention, and happily have an attempt at some questions. The question is about the fact that within the Eurozone you have a number of countries who have differing levels of productivity and productivity growth, and we could say, you know, certain different cultural aspects, so, but they're all in a single currency, so how workable is that? That's the question that was frequently asked in the late 90s, just as the euro was about to be implemented, and that was that was the standard question, really, that economists of an Anglo-Saxon persuasion like me tended to put. In economist language, it was, is the euro an optimal currency zone? Because for an optimal currency zone, the criteria usually are things like labour mobility, fiscal transfers and things like that. And to what extent did the euro area, as it was then proposed, and it's even broader now, to what extent did it fulfil those criteria? And I think the truth is that what we've seen is we saw a degree of convergence on some criteria, inflation and so on, that was achieved in the lead-up to the establishment of the euro. But in the ensuing decade, you have seen some quite pronounced differences emerge in levels of unit wage costs because productivity trends in countries were different. You've seen the so-called Growth and Stability Pact, which was all about containing budget positions and debt positions. That was a pact honoured more in the breach, really. And it was in fact a very important signal when the French and the Germans at one point were not abiding by that and they faced no sanction at that time, even though they should have under the rules. And I think that was actually a bad signal to all the others. And so we've ended up with some countries with fiscal positions which have become untenable, and they're countries which are under pressure now. So you've had these divergences. And really, this is one of the things that's causing the strain now. I think most people would say, wouldn't they, that to keep the euro workable, and the commitment to do that in Europe is intensely strong. This is the thing that we all missed when we were expressing reservations a decade ago. It wasn't just about economics. It was about much more than that. It was about geopolitics and so on as well. And the commitment to continue it is very strong, but it's clearer, I think, that the conditions associated with that are going to involve not only restrictions or a stricter approach to public financing, but a stronger Europe-wide structure of governance generally. And that is the thing that they're trying to work towards. And in Europe is complicated, everything takes a long time. That's the direction they're trying to go in, and I think that's going to be an important precondition to keep the whole thing sustainable into the long term. I think the other condition is going to be the one that I referred to in the speech, namely, some of these losses are going to have to be shared around, including into some of the countries that are at the moment not that keen to take that load.
For balance, a question from the very back of the room. This will be the final question.
I'm sorry I've taken too long to answer, but not
at all. Mr. Stevens, Graham Powell, ABC News in Perth. Thanks very much for your speech this morning. Earlier this year, you made it quite clear that the next move in rates was going to be up. Are you now saying that there's an equal opportunity that the next move in rates may be up or down?
Well, what we said earlier in the year was that the outlook as it presented then suggested that policy would at some point need to be tightened. They were the words we used. Those sorts of statements can only ever be conditional on an assessment of the outlook, and as I've been saying, that assessment can change. I'm not going to speculate on near-term decisions. I think we're well positioned at the moment to respond to whatever comes along. And, we need to keep an open mind over about what our response to events might be. But I have no particular comment on in which direction that might be, and certainly not on timing. What we'll be doing is, and this is the thing I've tried to make clear today, there's a framework for thinking about this. We analyse the information within that framework, and the policy decision is guided by the outcome of that process, and that will continue to be so.
Tug.